but rather in a somewhat fancy obstetrical clinic in Vienna, Austria. I was born in the same room, or delivered in the same room as the pretender to the throne of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, Otto von Habsburg. That's where our relationship began and ended. On October 19, 1918, just the months before the Austrian Emperor fled and abdicated. So I was still born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I was a subject of the Kaiser for less than 30 days. I grew up in the Austrian Republic between the two wars. I became a student at the University of Vienna, majoring in chemistry. My studies were interrupted by the invasion of Austria by the Nazis. I stuck around for 6 months, then went to Italy where my mother was in business. Lived in Milan until the Munich crisis of fall of 38, when I received a mobilization notice from the German army, which had taken over the Austrian army. At that time, there was pending a scholarship application, international scholarship application, with an agency in Geneva, Switzerland, and I thought this might be a good time to check on it. So I went to Switzerland in a somewhat irregular way, but I got there and stayed there until my scholarship came through, which was at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where I continued my chemistry studies, except that I also acquired a second major in geology, a minor in physics. I graduated in 1940. I spent roughly 8 months of World War II in England and Scotland. Served as an air raid warden, air raid warden in London for a short time. Was married to my first wife, and upon graduation, and we came to the United States in May of 1940, steaming past the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor on a bright sunlit day in the traditional way, everybody on the upper deck cheering. I stayed in New York for a few months looking for work, any kind of work. And then with the help of a agency that assisted newly arrived immigrants who had no immediate employment, and mainly their policy was to get people out of New York. They tried to resettle the two of us with our college degrees on a farm in Texas, and I wouldn't go, so they guess they got mad at us and sent us to Baltimore, Maryland, and started work there for Johns Hopkins University Physics Department. Then went into private industry, worked in various chemical type industries, eventually became a research chemist and with a firm in New Jersey. By this time, the United States had gone and entered the World War II, and I went to work as a civilian for the Coast Guard in the port of New York, working on a testing laboratory, a quality control type thing, metallurgical lab. I was injured in the lab explosion in the summer of 43, and at that point, during a long period of convalescence, decided to become serious about something I had kind of toyed with for a long time, which was to to law school. Accepted by the University of Maryland School of Law and enrolled in the fall of 43 in an accelerated program, 3-year program, which included summer school. I graduated in 45. When I say 3 years, compressed into two. I graduated in 45, head of my class, COIF, Law Review. I placed first on the Maryland bar exam. They announced the top five in those days. Then started making the rounds of the good law firms, and they were profoundly disinterested in my talents. They were only interested in how much business I could bring in, which was zero. After a brief stint with a real estate firm doing closings and such, getting a little bit of practical experience, I received an appointment as an adjudicator in the Minerals Division of the U.S. Department of the Interior in Washington, D.C. I was promoted shortly thereafter to be the head of the acquired land section, which under a reorganization plan administered mineral leasing on all lands acquired by the federal government as distinguished from the public domain, and conducted a number of major oil and gas lease sales. In 47 I was RIF'd, RIF, reduction in force. Went to work as an executive assistant to the president of an outfit called National Laundry in Washington, D.C., and was called back to the Interior Department. Stayed with them until 48 when I quit and went into private practice in both Baltimore and Washington, D.C., commuting between the two cities. In 1950, I was near bankrupted by a major case, which I had devoted all my time to, and which would make a fine story in and of itself. Obviously, it's outside the scope of your inquiry here. I then decided to go back into a temporary agency of the government, to wit, the Office of Price Stabilization, which was created under President Truman's administration to deal with the runaway inflation which occurred during and after the Korean conflict. I was soon promoted to become the chief counsel of the meat and fish branch of the OPS. In that capacity, I traveled to an industry meeting in the summer of 52, I believe. No, it may have been 51, to Seattle, which was my first trip anywhere west of the Rockies. I had always wanted to come west, and believing that the most painless way to relocate would be to try to get a government transfer of some sort to get my roots somewhere, I started scrounging around for a West Coast job, preferably Seattle. Also, of course, the OPS was a temporary agency and was getting ready to fold, and so it was logical for me to look for something else, and this is the way I went about it. I located a job with the National Labor Relations Board as a trial attorney in Seattle, which was perfect, what I wanted. Before I could actually be appointed, a lawyer who had gone into another temporary agency, the Wage Stabilization Board, had reemployment rights and bumped me, but the NLRB chairman of the board at that time liked me so well that he offered me a job as a field examiner, which is a quasi-legal job in Minneapolis, which wasn't exactly where I wanted to go, but I figured, well, I was halfway there, so, and I could always, you know, try to, once I was in the agency, try to get there. Well, pretty soon they called me and said, sorry, but that's a civil service registered job and we can't give it to you, but the chairman is so impressed with you, he wants you on his staff here in Washington. Well, of course, that's not what I wanted. So that day, I had taken that day off, and I wandered by the Interior Department offices to visit some old friends of mine, and I told them my sad disappointment, and they said, hey, you want to go to the West Coast? We're looking for a regional chief counsel in Portland. The deputy general counsel of the agency was holding that job down on a temporary basis, wanted to come back to Washington. And they said, go see Jack Wasserman, the general counsel. I know he thinks a lot of you, and you can have that job. So I made an appointment. Saw Mr. Wasserman, and he said, gee, I wish I had known about this before. I've already hired a guy named Bishop. He's coming in next week. But you can have the number two slot in Portland, or you can... This morning, I received a letter from Abe Barber, who is our regional chief counsel in Alaska. And he's already past retirement. He took the job for a couple of years to get Social Security benefits. And he doesn't want to spend another winter. And I would like you to go up there. We've got some problems up there. Some irregularities going on. I need somebody I can trust and who's not going to be hoodwinked. They want somebody else, but they can't have him. The somebody else they wanted but couldn't have was a gentleman named Hugh Gilbert, who later became a judge. And he said, you go up there for a year, do a good job, and you can have your pick. You can have San Francisco, you can have Santa Fe, you can have Albuquerque, all the good spots, you know, as chief counsel. And I said, okay. My wife, first wife at that time, was the secretary to the assistant director of the Park Service and worked in that building. And I took her out to lunch in the cafeteria, and I said, how would you like to move to Anchorage, Alaska? And she said, go. Okay. So we went, and then in October of 52, just lacks a few days to 30 years ago, we arrived in Anchorage on a Boeing Stratocruiser, which had to land in Elmendorf because there was no airport capable of taking a plane of that size. And of course, there were no porters and no cabs. And they had arranged for us an apartment for us on Government Hill. We spent the first couple nights at the Old Westward in the wooden wing. And they moved into that Government Hill apartment. And there was a strike in Seattle Dockside, and all our furniture was sitting there until Christmas. And so we lived on army cots and out of boxes and used trunks, cabin trunks as tables and so forth for about 3 months. I had an office down in the basement of the old federal building, looking out on the pavement of G Street. I shared the office, a secretary, and a telephone with a regional adjudicator named Chester McNally. I tried to get at least a separate phone from my desk, since we had to hand the phone back and forth. But the regional administrator, a fellow named Lowell Puckett, also did now. He was very frugal, and finally, to convince him, I bought a little toy telephone, one of the five and dime stores, and put it on my desk. And every time Lowell Puckett called me on some office business, I would pick up that phone and say, hello, hello, I can't hear you, hello. Well, he finally gave in and gave me a phone extension, but we still had to share a secretary in the office. That is the precursor of the present office of the Solicitor of the Department of the Interior, which, when last I looked, occupied some rather magnificent and expensive office space right next to mine in the Peterson Towers.
Mm-hmm. Let me make you backtrack for a while. Ask some questions.
Sure.
About your early time in... you were born in Austria. What kind of work did your mother do in Italy when you went to Italy?
My mother originally was an opera singer, and she had been a permanent member of the Royal Opera in Torino frequent guest at La Scala and at the Vienna State Opera and at the Vienna Volksoper, or People's Opera. After my grandmother's death, she retired from her career. She still sang and gave concerts and sang in church, but she had lost her interest, and so she went into business for herself, export-import business of fashion accessories and some clothing, with an office in Milan and an office in Vienna. And so she had, you know, a ready place to go when we decided to leave Austria after the Anschluss.
What about your father?
My father was a physician who also taught at the university and later taught medicine in Switzerland until he came to this country. Both of them came to this country because of me in 1941. In fact, they were on the high seas on Pearl Harbor Day, and there was some question as to whether they were going to be turned back or not, but they did make it here.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I was the only effort. Which is very interesting because my mother was an only child. My father was one of 10. And my mother's father, my grandfather, was also a doctor. My maternal grandmother was one of 13. So it suddenly came to a zero growth situation.
How did you get the offer in Switzerland?
The scholarship?
The scholarship.
I don't remember how I found out about its availability. There was an organization called the International Student Service, which on a competitive, what they call non-assembled basis, in other words, not an exam, but based on your qualifications, had a series of scholarships available both in the United Kingdom and in the United States for people with outstanding scholastic records who were displaced by the Nazis for one reason or another. And so I put in an application and didn't hear for a number of months, and then finally decided to go see them, and they eventually came through. It was December by the time they came through, so when I finally went to St. Andrews, I arrived just before Christmas, and more than half the semester had already gone. It was a foreign language to me, which I had very little command of at that time. I had taken a little crash course early in 1938, you know, just...
No, English.
Oh, English.
Okay, now you're in Scotland.
Yeah.
What was in Switzerland?
Oh, in Switzerland, I just stayed until my scholarship came through.
Oh, okay. How did you get to Switzerland from Italy?
That's an interesting story, but it's kind of convoluted. When I was a chemistry student at the University of Vienna in 1937, the thing to do was to get summer internships in some industry that you might be interested in. I had taken a course in textile dyes, and through my mother's connection I found a factory or lab in Como, Italy, which would accept me. They were doing manufacturing and using textile dyes. And of course Como is a gorgeous resort place, a beautiful little town, and it was kind of a lark on the shores of Lake Como, and I spent the summer there and had a little summer romance going with a young lady named Elsie. I can't for the life of me remember her last name, but she was a German-Swiss lady, and she worked for a international shipping firm with headquarters in the town of Chiasso, C-H-I-S-S-O, in this Italian part of Switzerland. For customs reasons and convenience, that firm had its headquarters in the Swiss town of Chiasso and a warehouse directly across the border in a small Italian village called Ponte Chiasso, one word. And there was just a little one-lane road that led from Chiasso to Ponte Chiasso with a custom shack and a barrier, and she'd go back and forth between the main office and the warehouse all day, so she never had to show any papers. And if we went out on a date, if she didn't want to come to Como, which sometimes she didn't want to, rather have me come into Chiasso. And so I wouldn't have to go through customs all the time and have visas issued and all that. We would meet in a little cafe in Ponte Chiasso, and then she just would walk me past the customs people, and they'd wave her through, and I could stay in Chiasso and come back the same way, whatever I want. Well, in the following year, when I was in Milan and got this mobilization order to report for transportation back to the fatherland, and I decided I want to go to Switzerland. We had corresponded for a little while, but it petered out. You know, we were both very young. I was 19, I think she was 20, 21. But I thought, well, I'm sure she'll still remember me. I'm a typical male arrogance, and called her, and yes, indeed, she did. And I said, I had a passport, of course, a valid passport. I also had a Swiss visitor's visa, which I had obtained as a precaution. But the Munich crisis was on, and there were mobilization in all the countries, and blackouts, and the borders were closed. And my fear was I could have gotten on a train in Milan and gone to Switzerland. But if the Swiss, as the radio hinted, were closing down the border, if I were turned back with my Austrian passport, and the Italians started checking, and of course they were allies of Hitler, they might have found out that just a few days previous to that I had received call-up orders and I was supposed to report to the German consulate for transportation back to Austria. And pretty soon I would have been treated as a deserter, and God knows what would happen. So I couldn't take that chance. So I called Elsa and asked her to meet me at Ponte Chiasso, the way we had in the past. And I didn't explain too much on the phone, but when I got there, I had a big steamer trunk with all my junk in it. And I explained it to her, and she said, no problem. And she sent some of the porters from her office over to get my steamer trunk and run it through customs. And then it was drizzling, and she had a little umbrella, and I took it, and she took my arm, and we walked through the barrier there, and the customs people waved at us, and we waved back, and I was in Switzerland. The next morning, I got on the train to Geneva, and when I arrived in Geneva, I had another problem. You see, Geneva usually goes politically the opposite of the rest of Switzerland. When Switzerland is democratic, Geneva goes right-wing. When Switzerland, the rest of Switzerland goes conservative, Geneva has a socialist government. Well, at that time, the Social Democrats had all of Switzerland, and a sort of a fascist group had Geneva, and they were very anti people who were either in fact or in appearance refugees from the Nazis. Okay, and of course, any foreigner in Switzerland then as now who wanted to stay longer than a certain period of time had to register with the police. And the Geneva police at that time were a bunch of fascists. And I had to register, so I went there, and of course I did not have an entry stamp in my passport. But fortunately at that time I still spoke rather fluent French, and I appeared fairly neat, clean-cut looking at the prefecture, presented my passport and registered. And the guy looked at me suspiciously and he said, "Where's your entry stamp?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "I got on the train in Milan in the sleeper, and somebody knocked at the door and said, 'Passports, please,' and I handed mine out, and then they put it back, finally brought it back, and I stuck it in my coat pocket. I didn't look at it." And he looked at me and he says, "They're getting more careless all the time." And I had my entry stamp. And that's how I got to Geneva, and then I stayed there for, let's see, this would have been in September. I stayed till December when my papers from Scotland finally came through, and got on the train, stopped over in Switzerland stopped over in Paris between trains from one railroad station to the other for a couple of hours, just long enough to get a former classmate of mine out of jail, and that's another story which I won't bore you with. Hopped on the next train, got up to Dieppe, Dunkirk. This was before Dunkirk became a well-known place. Dunkirk to New Haven to London, where I was met by some distant relatives who I'd never met before, but who took me in very kindly and gave me a temporary home until I could go up to Scotland. And then I got in there and spent the next several weeks cramming, you know, because one of the conditions of my scholarship, I had to pass all my courses and a lot of other conditions. And so most of the teachers gave me their own personal books, and I crammed and tried to brush up on my English as much as I could. And about 3 weeks later, I had to take a bunch of examinations. It was tougher than Hades, but I managed.
What happened to your parents?
Well, they were in Switzerland at this time. They had my father and mother had left Milan shortly after I went to Geneva and settled in Lucerne. First they went to Zurich, and then my father received a commission from the Swiss government to teach basic medical courses to dentists who, for their qualification for the state board, and to conduct seminars.
Was your father a dentist?
No, he was originally, his first love was interesting. He then became a neurosurgeon. He was a general surgeon in the army in the First World War. He was commandant of a hospital train. And then in Switzerland, he just taught these medical courses to the dentists. And then when he came to the United States, he went back to his first love, which was internal medicine, and practiced in Baltimore until he died.
When you were in Baltimore, when you had your private practice, your first private practice in about 43?
48.
48. What kind of practice was it?
Well, my first, I did not go in by myself. My first job was with a man whom I consider one of the leading trial lawyers in the country, and certainly the finest trial lawyer I have ever met. His name was Duke Avnet, A-V-N-E-T. And he was primarily a labor and personal injury, plaintiff's personal injury lawyer. And I had a one-year seminar at his feet, which started me out, and I feel I learned more there in that 1 year than in my years in law school or ever since. And since he paid me next to nothing, he was able to really take a lot of time with me and teach me and bring me along gradually, whereas nowadays young lawyers who get started at what would then have been considered astronomic figures, it's economically impossible to spend the time to really train them as they should be. And of course the law schools don't train you for trial work, totally inadequate. As a result, we have trial lawyers today that really haven't been properly trained. They learn by trial and error, except there's nobody there to critique the error, so they never do find out what they did wrong. And this is where Chief Justice Berger and I, the one thing we agree on, which is the total inadequacy of most of the trial bar, which is fine with me, makes it easier on me. I can be the one-eyed among all these blind people and therefore be king.
Did you have any cases with Duke Avnet?
Oh, yes. My first solo trial was a capital first-degree murder trial, which I was appointed. Mm-hmm. And I tried that all in one day. No jury, because my client was black and the victim was white. In Maryland in 48, you didn't take a jury in that situation. The judge was very tough. about 8 o'clock in the evening, the 7 o'clock in the evening, the state had finished its case. The judge called me up to the bench, and he said, first I had told him that I wasn't qualified to handle this. He said, don't worry, the co-defendant has a retained lawyer, a very experienced criminal lawyer. You just be a good learning experience for you. So I said, okay. Well, halfway through the trial, the case against the co-defendant was dismissed because the only evidence they had against him was a coerced confession, which was so bad that even that tough old judge threw it out. And here I was flying solo, committing all kinds of horrendous blunders. But at 7 o'clock, the judge called me to the bench, and he said, I don't know what your evidence is going to be, of course. And Duke assisted me at this point, because I was in a panic. And he said, if your client were inclined to change his plea right now, I'd give him a life sentence. If I convict him, mm-hmm. he'll hang. He'll give you 10 minutes. So I went. My client was sort of a slightly retarded fellow. His mother was a registered nurse and fairly intelligent, so I went to her first, and she says, boo-hoo, I don't know. You're the lawyer. So then I went to him in the holding tank, and he says, hell no. He says, I'm not doing life in the joint. He says, roll them dice. So we rolled them dice, and at 10 o'clock the judge acquitted him. And I think if it had gone the other way, my law career would have ended right then and there. They used to have in Baltimore at that time, or in Maryland, what they called a swing club, an unofficial organization of lawyers who had lost a client or more to the gallows. And I had no desire to ever join that. And incidentally, that was one of the things that made a firm believer of me as far as the death penalty is concerned. I am unalterably opposed to it, and I can see pros and I can see cons. But there is one argument against the death penalty which is unanswerable, and which most of our politicos never address, mostly because they're not lawyers and don't understand the thing. The only guy that was a lawyer and should have known better was Steve Cooper, but I guess he felt the political pressures and he had to say it, although I don't admire him for it. He's a good friend of mine. I've brought him to Alaska. He worked for me in the Attorney General's office. He worked for me in my private office. I voted for him, but I still think it was a less than admirable thing for him to embrace the death penalty, because he should have known better. And the argument that I'm talking about is simply this. Not even the wildest, most wildly optimistic supporters of our criminal justice system will claim that that system is more than 80% accurate, given all the vagaries of the relative skills of lawyers, the financial means of the defendant vis-a-vis the financial resources of the prosecution, the happenstance of juries, the predilections of judges. I mean, there are so many random factors that 80% accuracy is very optimistic. But for the sake of argument, let's say it's 80%. So you get 10 people who are condemned to die because they're convicted, and two of them are innocent on a statistical basis. How can you live with that? How can you put a person to death and find out, as happens very often now with people in prison, hey, we got the wrong guy? 16 years, a guy with the most recent story, were 16 years in prison until he was released because they found out somebody else did it. What do you do if the guy's long gone and dead? How can anybody sit there and say, well, I don't care about that, you know? How could anybody live with that? Ever? And so, you know, I just can't go for the death penalty, no matter what the emotional appeal is. I mean, you look at Charlie Manson, you look at Juan Corona and these horrible cases, and you say, oh my God, or Son of Sam or whatever. Wouldn't it be much cleaner to just put them away, you know? Yeah, but those are easy cases. But what about, you know, the guy that... Take a guy like that Danish count, I forget his name now, that supposedly killed us. Yeah. I think he's guilty, okay, from what I read in the newspapers. But do I know he's guilty? No, I don't know he's guilty. And it's all circumstantial, right? Well, if they had a death penalty, he probably would have been convicted of that. What if he didn't do it? That'd be horrendous. I mean, there's a strong possibility that that was self-inflicted on her part.
No.
Okay. Enough on that subject.
When you first started looking for a job out of law school, why was it so hard?
Economy was bad. This was 1946. I was an immigrant. I had no social connections. One senior partner in a fancy firm said to me, you know, what we're looking for is the kind of guys who can become junior members of the country club and bring in important business clients and have family connections. He says, your talents, of course, your achievements, scholastic achievements are impressive, but he says, we can hire that kind of for any, you know, easily, any day. And I said to him, look, I've got to get experience somewhere. I said, why don't you just hire me and don't pay me? And then after a while, you can figure out whether I'm worth something to you. And the answer was, yeah, we'd have to give you a desk and part of a secretary. I mean, that was the way. If you didn't come, well, I had these strikes against me. I didn't come from a big name law school, right? I went to see Abe Fortas, who had given me my first job with the government, hired me, mm-hmm. And
was he in the Interior Department?
Yeah, he was under Secretary of the Interior, and I went to him. This was after I had been with the Interior, not when I got out of law school. Well, this time I'd already had my experience with the Interior Department.
Was he with Arnold and Porter?
Yeah, Arnold Fortas Porter. And they only hired Harvard. Yeah. It's just, to my way of thinking, absolutely ridiculous. Not because sour grapes. I mean, I don't care. If they said, well, we only hire Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Columbia and Michigan and Stanford, okay, you want the top schools, fine. I think it's stupid, but okay. But no, they only hired Harvard. It's like inbreeding, you know. And I've seen a lot of Harvard lawyers that don't impress me at all. Anyway, so they're just... You just didn't have a chance if you were not, you know, long time family, old family with social ties or top school, name school. The mere fact that I went to a good grade A recognized school was garnered up all the possible honors, had the recommendation from the dean for a teaching position, that didn't mean anything. Today, you know, I could have written my own ticket with that kind of qualifications. And when I got a government job that paid slightly over $3,000 a year, I thought I was rich. Nowadays, we pay that to an associate per month. If he has any experience at all, and we pay damn near that much when he's fresh out of law school and gets the bar. Of course, I realize that's not the same money, but... Still, the opportunities today are much greater than they were then, which is good. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be, but it was very discouraging, let me tell you, because, you know, I had really worked hard in law school and concentrated on getting good grades because I knew that's the only thing I would have going for. I'm not saying it didn't help me getting the jobs which I did get, but I certainly didn't open the doors to the private law firms.
So the government was willing to look at good grades and high
scholastic achievement? Yes and no. I had to have pull, too. I had a cousin in Washington who was a bigwig in the government, and he introduced me to Abe Fortas. If it hadn't been for that, I probably wouldn't have got that either.
Did you Did you have problems because you were an immigrant?
Well, not expressed, but...
Did you feel that there was discrimination?
Oh, yeah, of course. Not immigrant per se, but the fact that I didn't have local roots, I didn't have a family name to point to. And the East Coast is very much that way. And of course, my biggest mistake was that I went to the East Coast to get my start. I think in California or Alaska, I could have made would have had a totally different start.
End of your law firm, your private practice with Duke, was that with Duke Evnick?
Yeah, I was with him for 1 year. I quit because he had been a New Deal Democrat, in fact a national member of the Maryland delegation to the National Democratic Convention in 1944. In 1948 he jumped to Henry Wallace's Progressive Party, and I started getting some bad vibes from the Bar Association and various people, and because he was so radical, and I didn't share his views, and I was getting tired with the brush, and so I left him on friendly terms. In fact, he said to me, Ed, he says, I had problems getting admitted to the Bar Association, which was not integrated, because of my association with him. And Duke said to me, Ed, I don't want to hurt your career. I said, maybe you better leave. And I did. And worked for another lawyer briefly and then formed my own firm of Borco and Mercaldo, M-E-R-C-A-L-D-O, a young Italian lawyer who was very active politically. We practiced out of the office of a man named Jacob Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N, who was a city councilman in Baltimore, also a labor lawyer, but more mainstream type, you know. Mm-hmm. Not as radical as Evnick. And we were just tenants and got overflow, but we did very well until we got involved in a big fight representing the local Boilermakers Union against the International. We were just smothered by... We had a winning case, but we were smothered by economic power and political influence. It was very funny. The judge before whom we tried the case was you could pick your judge as a plaintiff in Baltimore because each court had a separate clerk's office, and you could file in that court. Mm-hmm. And Emory Niles was an aristocrat, and he was a law school professor, a part-time. And I figured no way would he be favoring a corrupt international labor union when the rank and file was trying to throw off the yoke, you know, against the trusteeship. What I didn't realize is that Emory Niles wanted to go on what is called the Court of Appeals, which is like the Supreme Court in Maryland. And the governor at that time was a Republican named Ted McKeldin. When Ted McKeldin was mayor of Baltimore, his solicitor and closest confidant was a man named Simon Soboloff. And so, well, Soboloff, S-O-B-E-L-O-F-F, McKeldin, M-C, K-E-L-D-I-N, Ted McKeldin. And when McKeldin became governor, of course, Simon Soboloff had his ear on all judicial appointments. And so Judge Niles, and I later learned this from one of Soboloff's partners, Judge Niles catered to, we tried the case on that, we totally devastated Soboloff and his associates. And they brought in all the bigwigs from the International, president and vice president and the general counsel, and we just destroyed them. Niles told Soboloff that we didn't have the money to appeal and he was going to rule against us, and he did. It so happened that a year later the local threw out the rascals anyway, and then I arrived in Alaska, if you didn't have a known address, they used to have the Signal Corps had the communications, and the old federal building there was the post office, and they'd have a telegram arrive, they'd post it on the board, and there was a telegram posted for me from the Boilermakers local in Baltimore asking me to come back and be their attorney. Well, I had burnt my bridges behind me, but the young lawyer who had worked with me on the case and who is now a Superior Court judge in Baltimore got that. I recommended him, and he got that as a retainer, which was very helpful for a young lawyer starting out. Well, came the time for the vacancy on the Maryland Court of Appeals, and of course Judge Niles put his name in, and guess who got the job? Simon Sobolo. And Emory Niles died in office on the Superior Court bench. And then Simon Sobolov quit the Court of Appeals to become Solicitor General of the United States because Felix Frankfurter was ready to retire. And this was considered the Jewish seat on the Supreme Court, right? So Sobolov was a candidate, and Frankfurter would not resign until he was able to handpick his successor. Well, in order to be able to look him over, it was arranged that Sobolov would become the Solicitor General, so he would appear in the court, and Frankfurter would be able to evaluate him. Well, old Weenie didn't like Simon. And so Simon didn't get the job, but he got a consolation prize. He went on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and eventually died in office as the chief judge of that court.
Okay, so that led me
to Alaska, because I had to quit practice. That case broke me, mm-hmm. And that's when I went into the OPS, and out of the OPS I came to Alaska. It's funny how fate directs these. Friends of mine who told me, you know, knowing me, they thought I would thrive in the West, uh-huh. And I should get away from the East Coast. And so I was mentally prepared for that. And when I came to Seattle, number one, I got there in August, and it had been 6 weeks without rain, and the sun was warm, and the sky was bright, and I was given the VIP treatment, taken all over the city and shown the beautiful homes and the gardens on Mercer Island. And I thought, my God, you know, compared to Washington or Baltimore or New York, this was fantastic. And, of course, now that I've had lots of opportunities to compare Alaska, California, Washington to the East Coast, I feel totally confirmed. I in my original ideas, I would no more go back east than move to China. You know, I liked lots of things about the East Coast, the beautiful, lush foliage and this fall colors and all those things, and I miss those things. And I miss some of the amenities, although I think cities like San Francisco or Los Angeles or Seattle can certainly compete with New York or Washington without some of the horrors, you know, that go on there.
Yeah.
But if anybody were to entice me to take a job on the East Coast, they'd probably have to double what I would take on the West Coast.
When you first came to Anchorage, were you prepared for what you were going to see? Had people
No.
told you about what it was going to be like?
No. I had talked to Bob Bartlett briefly, and I had talked to a lot of people, but of course, like most Chichacos, I didn't believe what I was told. I bought all kinds of long underwear and warm, cold weather clothes, which I never needed, or hardly ever needed. It was very primitive when we got here, and we, of course, were faced with some hardships that we hadn't anticipated, like, you know, not having a decent place to live. Incidentally, I don't drive, and my first wife at that time didn't drive, and we didn't have a car, so I was riding the buses, and I would go out on Government Hill, I'd go out and stand in a foot and a half of slush waiting for a bus, you know, it was awful. And my job, despite its high-sounding title, you know, was I had a very lousy setup. I had made a good salary, but and we had some savings, and they were eaten up in the first few weeks of being up here. You know, and there's always a lag before you get paid. And we were very disenchanted for a long time. It took me about 6 months to a year to really begin to like Alaska. And
When did you come? What was the year?
October 52.
October 52. Did you take the bar exam right away?
No, I took I took the bar in 53.
Who administered the bar?
Nobody. I was admitted on reciprocity by the then Attorney General, who gave me a personal interview.
Who was the Attorney General?
J. Gerald Williams. Well, he asked me about my background, and I'd already filed a written application. And his famous comment to me was, anybody who has three entries in one volume of the federal appellate reports must be qualified. And I had done a lot of appellate work, and I had a number of cases reported in the First Circuit. Mm-hmm. And so I was simply admitted on reciprocity without having to take an examination. I did take the California bar 5 years later.
Where did you talk to J. Gerald Williams?
Where?
Yeah, where were you?
In the federal building, in the library.
So he came up to Anchorage from... You
know,
you didn't have to go down.
No. He was very informal. We became very good friends after that. Still are.
Mm-hmm. What was he like?
Very Alaskan. Loud, rough and tough, informal, smart, unconventional. Nice person, really, basically a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Were you here during the In Re Fink, Herman, and Arnett? And I think is when he talks about it.
I sure was. This was the first year I was here.
Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, they didn't pass the bar, and they sued. Mm-hmm. And I guess they didn't win the lawsuit because Fink never took the bar exam again. Arnett did. I don't know, there were three. I don't know who the third one was. I think there were three.
Russ Herman.
Oh, yeah, Russ Herman. Yeah.
Why do you smile?
Well, he and I made history years later. He was an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. Later became a U.S. commissioner. And I beat him in a leading case, which was the forerunner of the famous Timothy O'Leary case in the U.S. Supreme Court, mm-hmm. establishing the principle that an irrebuttable presumption of importation from the possession of a prohibited drug, thereby conferring federal jurisdiction, would be unconstitutional, and that you could rebut it, and I did, that this was a cocaine case. See, in order to give federal jurisdiction, the drug had to be imported. And since the government, in most cases, couldn't prove importation, there was a presumption of importation. And the presumption by law was made irrebuttable. Well, I totally rebutted it by evidence, and Herman was later asked by the Ninth Circuit, by one of the Ninth Circuit judges, he says, "Did you see what was being done to you? Because I was setting him up for total rebuttal, and he didn't attempt to come back with any other kind of evidence. Just relied on the presumption." And of course, that was used. I tried to use that in the Ninth Circuit later on marijuana. They declined to go with me on marijuana. There was really no distinction. But the Supreme Court finally did it in the O'Leary case, which wasn't my case, of course.
But back to the case, In re Fink, Herman, and Arnett,
mm-hmm.
up here, there was talk that if you were liked by the Attorney General or worked in the Attorney General's office, you could easily pass the bar, and if you didn't, your chances were much slimmer.
I don't think that's true. I think this. J. Gerald Williams was a very subjective type of a guy. He was an old-line politician who rewarded his friends and punished his enemies, and certainly, if he had disliked me, I wouldn't have been admitted on reciprocity. But I don't think he graded the bar exams. And whoever did was probably somebody like Tom Stewart. And Tom, you know, was so righteous. There's no way he would ever have done anything like that. At that time, Tom Stewart and Ed Mertes were the two assistants. And another guy, what the heck was his name? Oh, strange name. I can't think of it right now. Oh, yeah. Jack O'Hare Asher.
Yeah, his wife is here too, wasn't she?
Yeah. I've never met her.
Worked for Stevens.
Did she? Uh-huh. Boy, you know a lot of Alaskan history already, don't you? Bar history. Yeah, well, sure. That's the most interesting part.
Who else was here when you came up? Who were the other attorneys?
Well, the leading lights were people like Ed Davis, Bill Renfrew, John Hughes, Ed Arnell, Ray Plummer. Ralph Cottis.
Can I stop you with Ralph Cottis?
Yes.
Did you ever hear why Ralph Cottis didn't get the nomination for judge and McCary got it instead? Why did they keep it from...
I don't think Cottis was in the running. Manders was the man that was in the running.
Cottis was too.
Well, I don't know. Cottis... I don't know why Cottis didn't get it, but Manders got it first.
Mm-hmm.
And then McCary was substituted because Manders got vetoed by the White House.
You wouldn't pay his taxes.
Well, that's one version.
That's another version.
The other version was Manders was a very vocal supporter of Senator Taft, Robert Taft, and had made some very strong anti-Eisenhower, anti-Dewey remarks at the convention, which were noted by the higher-ups. I think the tax problem that he had with the IRS was used as an excuse, because they were good faith differences of opinion. And if he had been a politically fair-haired guy, they probably would have appointed him, but because he had, you know, John Manners was enormously outspoken, and he was another typical Alaskan maverick, you know, and he just wasn't politically cautious, and that cost him the judgeship, I think, more than the tax thing they dredged up and just used against him. I don't think that was the real reason. And of course, Manders would have been far more qualified than McCary, and certainly also more qualified than Cottis. But Cottis and Helen Tall were kind of an odd couple, you know.
Why?
Oh, they were just totally different. And kind of both a little strange.
In what way?
Their personalities, the way they tried cases. Give you a little taste of Cottis. When McCary first went on the bench, He found a large backlog of cases. So he had a guy named Hilton who was his clerk, also a Mormon. We used to call him Judge Hilton because the carrier delegated more power to him than he exercised himself. And Hilton was kind of a martinet bureaucrat. Anyway, McCary had this 3-full-day calendar call with every attorney in attendance and a thick volume of pending cases in front of him. Some of them would go back 10 years. And McCary had a 30-day calendar and a 60-day calendar and a 90-day calendar and a suspense calendar and I don't know what else. And he was just making little piles out of big piles. At this point, I was attorney for Chugach Electric, and there was a power struggle between the municipality of Anchorage and Chugach Electric. It went on for many, many years. And one of the border communities that was sort of a pawn in the game was an outfit called the Mountain View PUD, Public Utility District. Mountain View had not yet been annexed to the city of Anchorage. And the city had a frank declared policy of annexing as much of the Chugach territory as they could into the city and then just condemning their equipment for a forced sale value and incorporating it into the municipal light and power system, which would have been the destruction of the REA co-op. And so it was very important who controlled these outfits like the Fairview PUD, the Mountain View PUD. And there was a big power struggle going on with the Mountain View PUD. There were people resigned and they wouldn't appoint successors, and I filed a suit. Who's that? Are you expecting anybody? Anyway, I had filed a lawsuit against the Mountain View PUD on behalf of some of its constituents to compel them to fill those vacancies. And they had filed a spurious counterclaim for defamation because of an interview I had given to the newspapers. Cut it off just a second. Hi, Steve. They had this counterclaim, and it had been filed maybe 2 or 3 days before this calendar call came. And I sat through 3 days of this foolishness, and there were cases 10, 8, 7 years old, and they were put on these different calendars. I finally, and I had my big fat book because I had some of Vern Martin's old cases still and some of my own, and when all of my cases had been somehow shuffled around, I took my big book and I left, went across the hall to the law library, and a minute later the court clerk, the court bailiff, came running after me and he said, "Judge McCary wants you to go back in. He has a case he wants to set for trial." I said, "Oh." So I went back and he says, "Mr. Boyko," he says, "as a jury trial was scheduled for Monday," and this was on a Friday, "and it's just settled out, and I need a case to take its place. And Mr. Cottis tells me that you two have a case that's ready for trial." I said, "What case is that?" And he said, "So-and-so versus the Mountain View PUD." And I said, "Your Honor, that's not at issue. Mr. Cottis has filed a counterclaim, and the time for my reply hasn't even expired. You know, it's a brand new case." So McCary, in his typical way, he doesn't understand procedure or anything, right? So he turns to Cottis and say, "Counsel, what do you say with respect thereto?" And Cottis says, "Well, Your Honor, Mr. Boyko hasn't even asked the court for leave
to file a reply to the counterclaim. And McCary says, Mr. Barker, what about that? I said, well, nothing about that. There's no requirement that I ask leave of court to file a reply to a counterclaim. And with that, I pick up my calendar and walk out. And, of course, Cottes knew perfectly well. But, you know, he said something off the top of the head to deflect McCary. And he wanted the case tried immediately because of the political impact, you know, the suit had created, and he wanted to get rid of it and just use McCary's total ignorance to do that. But that's the kind of ethics, you know, and I shouldn't throw rocks at it, because eventually there were two factions formed, the purists, which were led by Roger Cremo, who said, okay, McCary is totally incompetent, you can't even reason with that man. So he more or less withdrew from the active trial practice. And then people like myself have said, hey, we've got an obligation to our clients. It's true you can't practice law in front of McCary, but you can certainly use child psychology. And I did, and I kept winning cases, because McCary goes around now saying that I never won a case in front of him, and that's his selective memory. But I almost never lost a case in front of him, and people would say, hey, you have the Indian sign on McCary. And I did, because I used the key words. I had a bet once with Roger Cremo. I was representing the bus company, which was a private company. It wasn't municipally owned then. And somebody had brought a personal injury suit against the bus company. And the bus company was self-insured, so I appeared and I said, Roger, I'm going to use one of McCary's little buzzwords, and I'm going to get that case dismissed. And one of his buzzwords was exhaustion of administrative remedies. And I filed a motion to dismiss on the ground that the plaintiff had failed to exhaust her administrative remedies when her claim was denied, she didn't go to the board of directors of the corporation that ran the, and McCary granted the motion. And Roger was furious with me, with McCary, with the world. Roger also was a fanatic about brevity in pleading and didn't like prolixity. And I had filed a motion to dismiss in another case against Cliff Groh because it was too verbose. No, because it was too short. It wasn't clear enough. And Roger had another motion pending against another lawyer because he said it was too verbose. Well, McCary granted my motion against Groh because the complaint was too short. And so when Roger's town attorney says, forget it, I don't even want to argue it. See? So that's the kind of law that... And Cottes, and I must admit myself, were people who just said, well, we've got to live with this guy, and so let's take advantage of the of his funny mind and win cases, because that's what we have to do. But, you know, arguably, ethically, that was probably, Roger's purest stand was probably more honorable than ours.
Can you split the people into who were purists and who took advantage?
No. I'm sure most of us took advantage. There were a few purists, and the only one that strictly comes to mind is Roger Cremo, because he was the outspoken critic, and he at one time started a collection of McCaryisms by getting transcripts from the court reporter and of some of these totally absurd sayings of McCary. And don't get me wrong, I like old J.L. He's a nicer guy as you'll ever meet. Except when he was on the bench, he was like Captain Queeg, you know. He was so terrified of the job that was over his head that he became a holy terror. When McCary found out about Roger having these transcripts, he instructed the court reporter not to release any transcripts in which he had said anything unless his law clerk first reviewed them. And that was Kay Ritchie. And Kay Ritchie not only reviewed the transcripts, but she ruled on all the motions. And Kay was fairly young and attractive in those days, and there was a group of lawyers who won motions by charming Kay. And I was one of those people who wouldn't cater to her, so I had a little tough time winning motions for a while until she quit as law clerk. But later on, I had her working for me in the AG's office, and I changed my mind about it. She was always bright, but I thought she was sort of susceptible to flattery, personal flattery. And that's how you won motions in those days, by flattering Kay Ritchie.
Who were the elite flatterers?
I don't remember. Most of the lawyers did. You know, there was always a whole coterie surrounding her and stroking her ego. And I wouldn't do it. So I lost to motions, but eventually I won him in the Ninth Circuit, so that made a believer out of McCary. After I reversed McCary three or four times, the next law clerk was Eugene Williams, L. Eugene Williams. And Williams told me that at one time I had filed some kind of a motion, and Williams prepared a ruling against me. I mean, the law clerks always rule. And when he gave it to McCary to sign, McCary said, "No, when Mr. Borko makes a motion, he usually knows what he's talking about. You better go back and check it again." But I had to reverse him a few times before he would became a believer.
Believer, so he always on your side.
He once told me, I came in for an injunction, preliminary injunction in case. And I said, "Mr. Borko," he says, "looks like you have a good case here, but you've already got more injunctions this year than any other counsel." Honest. And I felt tempted to say, "Well, how many to a customer, Judge?" You know. But that's the way his mind worked. It's a very peculiar mind, if you can call it that.
Yeah. Were you here when Rose Walsh was in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did they compare?
Very similar. But Rosie was a nice lady. I mean, McCary could be vicious and menacing. Rosie was the U.S. commissioner. Rosie Walsh was the U.S. commissioner. And therefore, if a U.S. government attorney, such as and she was not a lawyer, right? Incidentally, she married my mother. That is, performed the marriage ceremony for my mother. So I can't say anything back. This was not to my father, but to my stepfather. I'm one of the few people who can say that he attended his mother's wedding. Rosie was not a lawyer, didn't know any law, knew very little procedure. And therefore, since she was a U.S. commissioner, U.S. employee, any government lawyer, the U.S. attorney, or the chief counsel for the BLM, like myself, Interior Department, tried a case in front of her, which I did. I prosecuted some of these fire violation cases that the BLM had jurisdiction over in the woods. If she didn't know how to rule, she'd ask the government lawyer. Right? And that's how she'd rule. And her standard way of finishing would say, "I find you guilty of violating so-and-so and so-and-so. The fine is such-and-such. You may appeal. As long as you may appeal." She was cute, though. She was harmless.
Mm-hmm. How did it change when Gordon Hartley became commissioner?
Gordon's a good lawyer. I never practiced. I don't think they recall practicing in front of him. He had an assistant commissioner named Charles Tulin, who was a real pistol. Well, Charlie was fresh out of the Air Force, and he didn't know much law. He's a good lawyer now. He's a bright guy, but I never forget a case I tried in front of him. I had a guy. I represented a guy who had one of these fuel oil delivery services. They fill up your tank, you know what. Well, the plaintiff had left town for around Christmas time or something, and was gone for several weeks, and there was this automatic renewal of the fuel, but there was a time when there was about a week when there was a bad blizzard, and they were out in the Thule somewhere, and the truck couldn't get there. So the fuel ramp fell below safe level, But it was never quite clear whether that was caused it or some electrical failure, more likely electrical failure. And anyway, the furnace went out and the pipes froze up. Quite a bit of damage. So they sued this fuel guy, his name was Chenoweth, and I represented him. And a guy named Bailey Bell, that's Jess's father, was his lawyer. And Bailey...
Who's father?
Jess Bell. He's with Atkinson,
Conway,
Bell, and Gagnon. Anyway, Bailey Bell was an Oklahoma lawyer from Tulsa, and he was a lovable old shyster. I mean, he would try anything, okay? And he always wore a Homburg hat, and he was very formal. And this was a non-jury case in front of Tulin. And I had pretty much made mincemeat out of his case. So Bailey made his closing argument. And this, he says, look, Your Honor, he says, this defendant has insurance. And the insurance companies, do you realize that 40 cents out of every dollar in this country, Your Honor, is owned by the insurance company? He says, they ought to pay. Don't make any difference what exactly caused it, but let the insurance company carry this loss. And when I came back, I said, well, Your Honor, that's a novel argument, and I'm impressed by it, but you've got to carry it out to its logical extreme. Do you realize that 49% of every dollar in this country is owned by the federal government? The government ought to pay for this. More than 50 cents out of every dollar in this country is owned by women. My client's a man. He shouldn't pay. Well, Tulin didn't see the humor. He found for the plaintiff, and then it was reversed on appeal. Tried another case in front of Charlie. Drunk driving case against my janitor, who also had the territorial police officers on his beat, and he was driving. He had this Cadillac, and the territorial police didn't think a nigger should own a Cadillac. Certainly not their janitor, and they made a lot of comments about that. Well, one time his wife, janitor's wife, his name was Bailey, Alan Bailey, not Alan Bailey, Bailey. His wife, who was kind of a hellraiser, decided to go out to a party, and Alan, I think it was Alan Bailey, same as the prosecutor, only he was black and had sense. She took him out to a party or something and fed him some drinks, and Alan couldn't drink. He had two drinks and he got violently ill. But she wanted to continue partying for a while. No, she went in to get some coffee or something. And he sat on the passenger side on the parking lot with the door open, being sick. And a territorial cop came by who knew him, didn't like him because he owned a Cadillac, and arrested him for driving an automobile under the influence. The car was not running. It was parked on a private parking lot. And he was in the passenger seat. It was a harassment case, and they handcuffed him and worked him over. And I tried it at a jury trial. Got a hung jury, mostly because of Charlie Tulin's bad instructions. But they didn't bother to try it again. And then there was another guy named David Daines, who was an assistant commissioner. And he was a Mormon. And he was... Yeah, he was a lawyer, and he was one of the finest lawyers I met at about that time. I tried to get him to join me, but he wanted to go back to Utah, practice law. He was an excellent lawyer. And then Bill Moran,
got to be commissioner, and he was a fine judge, excellent, had the right temperament, and he was erudite and urbane, and was kind of fun. He was the best judge we had at that time. We had him and McCary, and God, he was so much better.
Who else was here?
Well, let me go on to Moran for a minute, because I was general counsel at Chugach, and I wanted to leave because they were getting a little bit too familiar with my being office there. In the beginning, you know, I was treated with great respect. And after I officed there for about a year, the manager would come by at 8:30 and ask my secretary, "Where's Ed?" You know. And when we got into some tough litigation, they suggested maybe we should take in outside counsel, you know. And I used to be outside counsel. So I decided I would go back into my own office, and I would retain them, they would retain me as their attorney, but they should have house counsel for the nuts and bolts stuff. And the board agreed with that, and they were on a search for house counsel. And Bill Moran was just getting ready to take the bar exam, and with a considerable amount of sensitivity not shared by some later judicial officers, he thought that on the possibility that he might flunk the bar and then would be sitting in judgment over lawyers who were members of the bar, he should not take the bar while commissioner, and so he resigned. We later on had a whole bunch of judges who continued to be judges after flunking the bar 2 or 3 times. But Bill felt that way, and he was looking for a job, and I thought he was just perfect. And he wanted a job for just, you know, a few months until he was admitted to the bar. And so I proposed him to the board of directors of Chugach, and they hired him. And that was, 25 years ago? He's still there?
Still there.
Just like me, I was going to have a one-year tour of duty in Alaska. Okay, who else was there?
Who else was there?
Okay, McCutcheon, of course. Buell Nesbitt. Don Burr and Charlie Tulin were still with the Air Force.
Stationed here?
Yeah, and Don Burr later on went into the U.S. Attorney's Office. John Manders, Harold Butcher, John Connolly, Frank Dunn, who later committed suicide. He had a terrible personal experience. Some intruder held him and his wife at gunpoint and forced them to perform sexual acts in front of him, and someone never recovered from that. They broke up his marriage, and his wife I'm not sure whether she became an alcoholic or just had other problems. I shouldn't say that. But he eventually committed suicide. I'm just giving you the ones that I perceive as being the successful, active ones. And I may be overlooking some important ones. Let's see. Bill Arnold.
Was he in Anchorage then?
Yeah.
In 53?
I'm pretty sure. If not, he must have come soon after. Let's see. Bert Biss at that time was a law clerk to Judge Folta, George Folta, and later on became city magistrate. George McLaughlin, after whom the McLaughlin Center is named.
Can you tell me a little bit about George McLaughlin?
Yeah. George was very brilliant, very gregarious. He was a consummate Irish politician. Mm-hmm. And very outgoing. He city magistrate and did a good job. Bert Biss, on the other hand, became a prosecutor on the bench. And there's a funny story about him and Neil McKay. In those days, if you had a case in front of the city magistrate, it would always be a criminal case.
you could appeal to the territorial district court and get a trial de novo. And you could give oral notice of appeal. You didn't have to file a written notice of appeal. After the judge announced his verdict and judgment, you just gave oral notice of appeal, and that stayed the judgment, and you went to the district court and started all over again. And Bert Biss had worked for Judge Folta, who was a prosecutor on the bench, and had totally imbibed his philosophy. And he would go so far as to ride with the cops the night before and watch them make busts and then arraign those same people in the morning. And Neil McKay, and he would also then have to set bond for the appeal, and he would set these outrageous bonds, and then I and a number of other people went down to the legislature and limited his power to set bond. And many times I would go, I had a policy. I would not try a criminal case in front of Bert, who incidentally was and is a friend of mine. I'm not saying this with any malice. But I would not go in front of Bert Biss unless my client, A, agreed to authorize an appeal, and B, I walked into his courtroom with the appeal bond already, except for the amount, in my pocket. Well, Neil McKay went one better. He appeared in front of one morning, on arraignment. He appeared with a client, and Bert was glaring down from the bench, saying, "Mr. McKay, how does your client plead?" And McKay said, "We plead not guilty, Your Honor, and give oral notice of appeal." And Neil came off the bench and Bert came off the bench and wanted to fight Neil.
Was there a separation between people who are on the bench, his commissioners, magistrates, and lawyers? We knew each other so well.
Oh, yeah. We were all friends. This was all very informal. The judges, too, until McCary came on the bench. McCary was very formal in his relationships. But Judge Diamond hadn't been, and certainly Judge Hodge wasn't. Folta was. Anyway.
Was that a difference between Juno and Anchorage that Folta was?
No, it was just Folta's personality. He's always been a government man, and he looked at the colonials here as slightly demented bunch of people that needed to be governed with a firm hand.
He feel the same way in Juneau?
Did he feel the same? Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about the territory of Alaska.
He felt.
Yeah. That was the approved government bureaucrat attitude. That's how I was taught to think when I first came up here, except there were some people in my agency that had gone native, in quotes, like they used to in the British, when the British carried the white man's burden in the colonial empire, and who started turning my mind around, and when I left, I was quite convinced that it was the Alaskans who were right and the government bureaucrats who were wrong. But the official doctrine then, as I'm sure now, in government circles, was that this was a land inhabited mostly by crazy people who had to be protected against their own folly, by people who had the infinite wisdom of, knew how to govern.
Did people who had that government frame of mind usually stay for long periods in Alaska?
Yeah, some did, and some, like myself, converted,
The ones who didn't convert, in the bar, who were they and what were they?
That continued to have that approach? That's a tough one. Because eventually, I think they all converted that stayed permanently. But I think Bert and Ted Munson, who was in Juneau, because he didn't stay too long, the Folta disciples felt that way. I think, even though he is a native son, Tom Stewart had a little bit of that.
men like Frank Heinzelman, who was a territorial governor. He was not a lawyer. Judge Forbes certainly had it. But I'm sure he lost it after he left the bench. He was a pretty decent guy. But most people who stuck around finally got caught up in the Alaskan spirit, which is admittedly quite different. But it's very contagious.
Do you remember any other people who were here?
Yeah, I'm sure I do. Let me think. Wendell Kay.
Grigsby.
Roger Cremo. Harold Stringer. He was with Connolly.
Tell me about Harold Stringer.
Harold Stringer is a very savvy, crafty politician who was a fixer, operator. He was national committeeman when McCary was appointed, and the bar rose up and said, "You can't do this to us, Harold." And he said, "You're going to get McCary whether you like it or not." And the first time McCary exploded and almost destroyed a lawyer, the victim was Harold Stringer.
Why?
Well, it was a combination of McCary and happenstance. The happenstance was that there was a disciplinary complaint brought against Stringer right after McCary ascended the bench. And McCary was the kind of a guy who would bend over backwards so hard to prove that even though everybody knew that he owed his job to Stringer, that he would do him no favors, that he toppled over backwards and went the other way because he didn't have the good judgment to... of course, what he should have done is disqualified himself and let some visiting judge handle it, or some other territorial judge, or where to more available. But he didn't have the common sense to do that. And so the trial became a three-ring circus, and then the next guy that exploded, you know, whose face it exploded was Dave Talbot. Because Dave, who had been in the U.S. Attorney's Office, either at the time or shortly before the Stringer incident occurred, was conscience-stricken about the way Stringer was treated and how the court and the U.S. Attorney's Office overreacted, and he testified on his behalf. And Jim Fitzgerald, who prosecuted, also overreacted. Everybody overreacted, and the next thing was a disciplinary prosecution against Dave Talbot.
What do you mean when you say overreacted?
Well, they overreacted to Dave Talbot, in effect, switching allegiance. They expected him to be part of the U.S. Attorney team, even though he was no longer in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mm-hmm. And he probably had been... Well, Dave, you know, was one of those... certainly one of those people who started out with that Pucker Sahib complex, and he was running around with Tom Merton, the hotshot U.S. Marshal who later became the model for Redford's Robert Redford's Brubaker. Mm-hmm. They would run around with six shooters strapped to their sides and staking out the last chance bar for morals violations and garbage like that, playing cops and robbers. And David was gung-ho, you know, His Majesty's government man. And when he turned and became a witness for Stringer, you know, that was like treason. And Fitzgerald felt betrayed, and
you know, everybody else and the U.S. Attorney's Office. And so the next guy to face the firing squad was Dave Tollin.